Welcome to episode 284 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. I've conducted many interviews over the past few years trying to get a straight answer to a simple question. Is there a business case for British Columbia LNG? Does it make economic sense to build natural gas liquefaction plants on the west coast of Canada? You would think such a simple question would have a simple answer. You would be wrong. The oil and gas industry says that yes, there is a business case, but has not provided the numbers to prove its claim. One economist I interviewed said the capital cost to build a plant in BC were twice what it takes in the U.S. Gulf Coast, and that the lower operating costs in Canada's northern climate did not make up for those higher costs. In other words, there is no business case. Now, a new report from Clean Energy Canada, An Uncertain Future, argues the case against Canadian LNG is far stronger than the case in favor. To discuss the report, I'm joined by Mark Zacharias, Executive Director of Clean Energy Canada. Welcome to the interview, Mark.
Welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, why don't you give me an overview of the report? We'll start there.
Well, we focused on three questions in the report. The first one is, are there going to be markets for BC LNG into the future? And particularly, are there going to be markets in Asia where we're best positioned to export to? And, you know, on that question, it really depends who you ask. We looked at every publicly available LNG trade forecast into the future out to 2050. And there may be some behind paywalls that we were not able to access, but we looked at everything public and we found out that basically if countries follow their climate plans and their plans towards net zero, we see LNG demand falling off the cliff in the coming decades. But if people stay with status quo, there could be LNG growth globally and in Asia. It really depends on who you ask. So that was the first thing. Second one was, is there enough electricity in BC to actually electrify and support all of the projects that are in the provincial EA process or out of it and under construction? So that's six facilities. We found there'd be about 8.4 new site Cs of power needed to support the industry. The third aspect we went after were the climate considerations. We hear a lot about coal to gas switching and how BC LNG would be a climate solution, particularly in Asian economies. And again, we went back and we trolled all the literature and we found, well, it really depends on who you ask. And it really depends on, you know, whether governments, provincial and federal, are going to stick to their climate policies on methane, on net zero emissions, on oil and gas emissions cap. And then the last thing we looked at a report very quickly, we looked at the impact on BC households in terms of what they would pay for electricity and what they would pay for utility gas.
Okay, let's talk about the business case first, because that's what I mentioned in the introduction. And on page 15 of your report, you do have some data from Wood Mackenzie that suggests that Canada, the price delivered to Asia is competitive. And we're not the cheapest, but we're also not the most expensive. And so that would seem to bolster the case of the industry and its supporters who say that we should build out more liquefaction capacity on the West Coast. And how are there other estimates, other modeling that you've seen that are either higher or lower than the Wood Mackenzie data?
Not that we could find. The Wood Mackenzie data seemed to be the one that kind of most illustratively looked at, are we cost competitive with the US on shipping LNG to Asian markets? And in that respect, yes, we are, according to that study. However, for those looking at the report, we'll also see that we are almost double the cost of Qatari LNG being shipped to Asia. A lot cheaper than Australian and a lot cheaper than Russian, but right in the middle of cost comparator with the US. Now, again, all of this depends on a whole bunch of things, right? Like it's the financial incentives provided to industry. You get relief on your provincial sales tax. Do you get relief on your corporate income tax? Do you get relief on carbon tax? You know, does government help with electrifying these facilities, either in the upstream, you know, or at the drive in the compression stage? All of that's unknown. The other piece, too, that really has a consideration on whether BC would be competitive is the federal and provincial government's climate policies. you know, if they stay and if they do what they say they're going to do, those will have cost implications on these projects. And then the other one more recently is just the labor source and labor costs of getting these built. And again, we tried, but we couldn't really find any information on that.
One of the things that's come up in the last, I'd say, 6 months is more information on the extent, the problem with measuring natural methane emissions leakage within the natural gas system. And this is not confined to Canada. The whole industry around the world has had a problem with measuring its methane emission leakage. Its technology was pretty outdated, and it's only in the last couple of years that we've seen methane emission satellites. We've seen remote measurement, that sort of thing. But the general consensus, I think, in Canada is that the emissions are actually 1.5 to 2 times what the official inventory numbers were. And that has cost implications because there's carbon tax applied to each one of those molecules. And so how might that factor into the cost implications?
Well, it really depends. Like, you know, if we get methane capture and methane prevention and leakage prevention to 75% to 90%, you know, obviously it cleans up the carbon intensity of the product, but it also could add costs on that. We also, again, we don't know what is going to be happening with the federal and provincial governments kind of oil and gas emissions cap in the next year and a half, 2 years or so. Again, all of that would impinge on, you know, whether the cost of LNG is cost competitive into markets, but also, you know, does LNG displace coal for the betterment of the climate? And again, you know, we were talking before the interview, and there's so many studies out there, and they're all over the map on whether LNG is a global climate solution.
Okay. Let's deal with that, because I've had a number of experts on this podcast, and the one that comes to mind is Anne-Sophie Corbeau. And Anne-Sophie worked for BP. She was head of their one of their gas divisions. She has been an analyst at the IEA and is currently a professor at Columbia University. She is very well versed in this. She was a little uncertain about, you know, giving me a prediction about when natural gas demand and when LNG demand would peak. But she finally said, she didn't stick with the 2030 IEA APS scenario. She said sometime in the 2030s. Okay, fair enough. Let's take that. If you were now to build, if we had a final investment decision on a plant on the West Coast in Canada, and by the time it got built, it would be what? We're in 2024 now, it might be 2027, 2028, 2029. What does that mean? That means a decade before LNG peaks. And then how long is the plateau, and when does it start to decline? And then when does that plant become uneconomic? Well, it could be a fairly short time. And if you're investing billions, that kind of uncertainty has got to weigh heavily on the companies looking at building these projects that have been proposed but not built on the West Coast.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other kind of denominator in that equation is the amount of new LNG coming on stream by 2030. So there is 43% more LNG that's going to be hitting the ships between now and 2030. And so the question then becomes, is any future demand increase in a lot of these markets that might be looking for LNG, is that actually met by this new 43% coming on stream, and for how long? So as you say, we are kind of looking at all the numbers here, and it's not clear to us that there won't be stranded assets at some point into the future. Because again, you know, we're looking at the global demand for LNG, you know, past 2040, it gets very, very murky. And it really depends on what happens with climate policy in the destination markets.
The argument is often made in Canada that the Canadian clean LNG, and that there's a lot of ifs in there, because clean is doing a lot of work. First of all, it assumes that the provincial government's going to enact regulations and the industry are going to follow them and clean up and get their emissions down to under 3%, at which point the LNG is better than coal. And in the case of Alberta and Saskatchewan, that is not the case right now. They're probably somewhere either at 3 or higher BC is different because it's mostly dry gas. That's mean it's not produced associated with oil, and most of the industry is electrified, which makes a big difference. Okay, so the problem then is the uncertainty around here around these projections. I tend to be on the more conservative side. I tend to think that the IEA has got it nailed, and I think that the case for that the industry makes for displacing coal in Asia is way overblown. I mean, first of all, China doesn't use much gas. Many of the other countries are not set up to use gas in their power sector, and with the continuing fall in the cost of renewables and the ease with which you can construct renewables and get them onto your grid or even off grid, I just don't see the case for that. I think that's overblown.
Well, there's two parts to your question there, and both are quite good. The first one, and this comes back to the fact that for 10 years now, we've been talking about how to create a price premium for low carbon or low carbon intensity LNG. And it hasn't happened, and it may have happened if there wasn't the Russian-Ukraine conflict, but just that created such chaos in the gas markets for 2 years that really we may never see a kind of price premium for that low-carbon LNG. So that's kind of setting that aside. And then there's the second question of coal to gas switching and where Asian markets are going. You know, our report using Japanese government data showed that, you know, over the last 14 years, this past year, 2023, Japan imported a lower amount of LNG than it's imported over the last 14 years. And that's because of post-Fukushima nuclear restarts. It's because of renewable energy, efficiency programs. We're also looking at the kind of demographics of a lot of these markets that we want to sell into. If you look at China, South Korea, and Japan, you see populations and you see total energy use. That's absolute total energy use. Populations that are declining and total energy use that's flat, and sometimes in some places like Japan is declining as well. One of the questions that we have in the report that we just can't seem to answer is we don't know whether a cargo of LNG is actually displacing like a dirty older coal plant, a newer, cleaner coal plant, renewables, nuclear, or something else. And, you know, until that math is shown, it's really hard to kind of make a judgment around whether our LNG is actually going to be going into coal switching or something else.
Yeah, I as many times as I've heard this, and I mean, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith is fond of making this argument all the time, but she's not alone. I mean, the industry does it. Financial analysts, I was thinking of Eric Nuttall, who's a Canadian-based and well-read financial analyst, and he did a piece in the Financial Post, or maybe it was the National Post last year, where he was in Qatar, and he said, well, look at what they're doing. Why can't we do this? That's not an argument. That you don't make a final investment decision on the fact that a competitor is pouring money into a particular industry. And it's the simplicity. Oh, and the other argument, of course, is that the only obstacle, to final investment decisions is federal climate policy or federal regulatory uncertainty. And I find all of these arguments are just not persuasive. And clearly, the executives who are making the final investment decisions for these projects don't find them persuasive either. Otherwise, they would have FID'd them.
It's kind of a great unknown here. The other one, too, is we know that for LNG Canada Phase 1, they have locked in contracts for, I think, minimum 20 years. We know wood fibers production has been, you know, off-taken by BP. You know, after that and kind of past 2030 or past 2035, it gets a little bit more murky for some of these kind of newer facilities that don't yet have locked in contracts. I think Silizms has a kind of proposed output of 14 million tons per annum, but only has a contract for 2 million tons per annum of that. So again, you know, we're looking at really uncertainty in the future market around all of this.
Let's talk about the power requirements for electrifying the BC liquefaction plants. LNG Canada, of course, is the whale on the West Coast. It's a $40 billion project. I forget what its output is, but it's fairly impressive. And the argument was that it would be the cleanest LNG on the planet, that it would be electrified using BC Hydro's, 97% hydro, clean grid. And now there's a lot of, there's some question about whether in fact that'll happen, whether BC Hydro will actually build the transmission in time, or whether the LNG Canada will have to go ahead with gas driven equipment, which is much more polluting. And it just doesn't seem like even the one plant that is planned for this is not certain. And they're being offered preferential electrification or electricity rates if in fact it happens. If you were to add 5 or 6 or 7 times more, I don't know where you get the power in BC.
Yeah. We've done some analysis kind of looking at the Western North American electricity markets. And let's say we guarantee an LNG proponent 24/7 power at 6 or just above 6 cents a kilowatt hour. In 2023, the average daily spot price from the Mid-Columbia market is near almost 12 cents. So, that works out to be about $600 million for one site C worth of power. So you can see that the costs could add up fairly quickly if we can't self-generate in DC. We also know we've got critical mineral mines, we've got green hydrogen production, we've got advanced manufacturing, and we've got a population that's growing very quickly and quite likes heat pumps and electric cars. So we've got this load growth developing very quickly in BC. And even 5 years ago, we did not expect that we would have, such a demand for EVs. So, we really need to kind of rethink the electricity system here, and LNG expansion is part of that conversation.
One of the things that has happened recently is that BC Hydro has finally, last year it released its integrated resource plan, and now it's planning for 2% load growth after 15 years of flat load growth. So clearly it's already preparing for electric vehicles and for heat pumps and other electrification, aspects of electrification. But it doesn't seem to be planning for electrification of LNG. And the capital plan that it has now says we're not, after Site C, we're not building any more hydro dams. That's our last hydro dam. And going forward, we're going to reach out to Indigenous communities, to independent power producers and others to build wind and solar that we will then contract, which is ironic given the fact that how vilified that was in 2017 when the government changed. Nevertheless, that's the way they're going to go. And it's a very sensible plan. Because you can use those big hydro dams as batteries, basically, for the renewables generation inside your province. I think that's a terrific idea. But if you electrify the liquefaction that's coming on stream now, LNG Canada and others, and you build out more, how many solar farms and wind farms can you build in BC? Certainly not enough to keep up with LNG electrification, I would suggest.
Yeah, absolutely. Hydro's kind of clean power call that's already been announced and is going to be happening very soon. I mean, that's a great first step, and we would hope that we would see similar calls pretty much annually over the next 10 years as they build up the supply. Now that they've got a better picture and better handle on what's going to be happening with demand. But again, we look at this and we look at, what it's going to cost to generate wind and solar in BC. We know they did it in Alberta about 4 or 5 years ago for, just over 4 cents kilowatt hour. That'll be hard to match in BC with inflationary pressures. So you're already producing power that's going to be more expensive than, what you're getting out of a lot of your hydro legacy assets. So that's going to be the cost of power, and then what kind of LNG and other large industrial proponents are going to want to pay for power. There's going to be a delta there that's going to be hard to meet. So I think that's kind of the first part of that question. And the second is the transmission. What we're advocating in our recommendations to government is government do what it did with the crypto industry. Basically said, no, we decide whether your application goes through or not, depending on where you are in the regulatory process. And we expect government probably in the next kind of year or two to actually create an electricity decision-making framework so they can figure out what exactly is the highest and best use of BC's electricity. Where should it go for the most jobs, the most return on government, the most revenues back into government to pay for all the social services? So we think it's very doable. They've already got the precedent with the crypto industry. So we would expect to see government do that in the next couple of years.
A couple of years ago, I interviewed Professor Kent Fellows, who's an economist at the University of Calgary, and he was looking at Site C, and he was asking the question, is it economic to go ahead with Site C, or should Site C be scrapped? And one of the things that came out of his study was that the value of a megawatt hour of hydroelectric power is much higher if you're using it to as a battery, as storage for renewables, which are very low cost. And when those two work together, he said, if you use Site C that way, then it would make economic sense to go ahead with Site C. If all you did was sell Site C as, you know, a, you know, 9 cents or 12 cents a kilowatt hour, which is basically what it's going for in BC now, it makes no sense whatsoever. And so that, if there's going to be a government decision-making process that looks at the value of a megawatt hour of hydroelectric power, then I think it would take those things into consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been a number of public commentators over the last kind of month or two, you know, suggesting that hydro's power imports over the last year or two have been, you know, we've been importing more than we sell, but, you know, as you say, right, our reservoirs are giant batteries and, you know, assuming that we have enough water in them and the hydrograph remains stable over the coming years, there's no reason hydro shouldn't be kind of importing cheap power to meet our needs and then selling it when it's expensive. So, yeah, and I agree with you on the battery side. You know, we are going to build out more renewables in BC and baseload power is going to be important and continue to be important. I don't know if you saw in the BC Hydro IRP, they also had, I think, around 500 megawatts of battery storage as well to kind of help load balance the system. And again, that's part of the equation and what every other jurisdiction is doing as well.
Yeah, we've done a number of interviews lately with people like Gerhard Schlage, from who's Chief Technology Officer at Hitachi Energy, who talked about how grids are changing and how you have to have storage and power electronics and digital controls and AI and on all of these new technologies in order to accommodate intermittent renewables and all of the other challenges that are coming with electrification. It's not just enough to, you know, double your hydroelectric output to meet, you know, the demands of a 2030 economy or a 2040 economy. You have to do things differently with your grid. Yeah. And it, you know, in fairness to BC Hydro, they seem to be now moving in that direction and probably quicker than many of other crown utilities in Canada, one could argue. But I want to talk now about climate policy, because if I remember my numbers correctly, BC right now emits about 64 megatons of greenhouse gas emissions. And the plan under Clean BC was to get it down to 16 megatons. And I can't remember if it was by 2030 or 2040. It might even have been 2050. But there is a plan in place. And everyone I've talked to about this issue agrees that if LNG is expanded in any significant way, then the chance of hitting those climate targets is almost impossible. And one would think that the government, I know the government wants economic development and wants the capital expenditure that comes with, you know, big LNG plants, but it's trying to, you can see them trying to balance that against the climate targets that they've set. How is that going to play out, do you think?
Well, you know, our analysis showed that the six projects that are, you know, in the process or under construction right now would add about 13 megatons of total emissions. That's upstream, midstream, and downstream. And, you know, as you say, we're looking for about 20 some odd tons reductions between, you know, 2018, 2019, and 2030. So there is a problem. There's a challenge there in terms of the math. I mean, to give government credit, you know, about this time last year, they had their Energy Action Framework, which basically said there's now emissions test in the provincial environmental assessment process. you basically have to be scope one or scope two, sort of net zero emissions. You can use some offsetting in there if you have to. So that was a good piece of this. The second part that we're looking for more details on is the provincial and federal oil and gas emissions cap. That's going to be very critical to figure out kind of how many of these projects can fit into the provincial climate targets and, you know, how many might not be able to do so. But again, you know, we haven't seen details on both these policies. We know the federal cap won't cover pipelines. Pipelines are a big source of emissions in BC. So the BC system will have to make up that deficit somehow, but expect to see something over the coming months.
I have a question for you, and this is, you know, builds on what you just said, but isn't directly related to the conversation we're having. And that is why the federal government, which already has a carbon, an industrial emitters carbon tax. And so all of the provinces have to have an industrial emitters carbon tax, and BC has one. Why, for their oil and gas emissions cap, they would layer on a cap and trade system? I don't understand that. Why don't you just toughen up the system that you have, you know, make it more stringent each year, rather than adding complexity and cost for everybody concerned?
Well, I think there are kind of two reasons for that. One is you would have to tighten up methane regulations and a carbon price. You would need to get further tightening over time to be able to kind of reach the same goal as, you know, setting an emissions cap. And the other two, I think the federal government is envisioning its emissions cap as somewhat of a backstop, right? You know, for global reporting mechanisms, if you can say, look, we've capped out at 130 megatons or whatever the number is going to be, or 135, whatever the number is going to be at the end of the day, it just makes it a whole lot easier to actually balance the system after that. And yes, you have to create a cap and trade system. And yes, you have to give facilities allowances. And, you know, but it also creates a credit system. So, you know, those good actors do get rewarded. And, you know, as you know, we've got a number of oil and gas assets that really are not all that clean. They're not all that efficient. And this is yet another way, you know, in addition to the carbon price, of actually making sure that, you know, there are no free riders in the system.
Okay, fair enough. I've heard the federal government make that case. I'm still not convinced that that's the most efficient way to go about it or effective way to go about it when they already have. I would have preferred to see increased stringency applied to the industrial emitters carbon tax. I think that would have been the better way to go. Who knows, maybe we'll have a minister wake up one day and go, oh man, I made a mistake on that. I need to go back and revisit that decision. But not likely. So where are we at then with the climate with the climate policy conversation? Because it seems like BC is one of the more cooperative jurisdictions with the federal government. It does negotiate equivalency agreements. So it puts in place provincial policy that are in line with federal requirements. And then the two governments sign off on it. And it seems to have a fairly cooperative relationship. But then this LNG is kind of hanging over it like the sword of Damocles, you know, and we don't know. So what's the current thinking about that? Are the BC climate targets going to be blown to smithereens, or what does the government think about that?
Well, I mean, you know, on the federal government side, is they've committed to no more subsidies for oil and gas. So, you know, they're very cautious around kind of what they incent and what they pay for. And that would probably include electricity transmission to some of these plants and using federal tax dollars to support those. You know, on the provincial side, I think the province is still in belief that they can make their 2030 targets. Again, all of this is predicated on a number of things. You know, the first and foremost is, you know, which projects, you know, get built, which ones get to FID. You know, you'd mentioned that LNG Canada's phase two, it's fully permitted. They could build that tomorrow as a gas-driven compression plant. Which would add another kind of 3.5 kind of megatons of emissions, and that would make reaching the BC targets that much harder. You know, obviously they're probably prevented by doing so by carbon pricing, which would make operation of that plant very expensive. So I think it's all fairly still in limbo right now. I think the province's commitment to kind of net zero LNG on the scope one and scope two emissions was a pretty good start. I think proponents are taking this very seriously, and they're actually looking at ways to electrify basically everything in their value chain, you know, right back to the upstream. So in that respect, it's having the anticipated effect of you know, having the engineers go back and go, how can we do this a little bit differently, which is actually very good. The other thing you mentioned too is like, we are going to be producing natural gas in British Columbia for many decades to come, you know, whether it's exported or whether it's used domestically. We're not getting off natural gas anytime soon. So we still are going to be a producer. So those wells and those projects in the upstream that have their approvals, if we can electrify them and reduce their emissions, that's going to be a good thing.
Well, before we get on to the question of how the households might be affected, I want to raise the issue of, because that's kind of down at the grassroots level. That's at the pointy end of the stick, as they say. But I want to attack, I want to ask a question that's grounded in the 35,000 foot level. We have done, I don't know how many, you know, dozens, probably hundreds over the last few years of interviews about electrification. Where are renewables going? Where is the cost of electricity going? Where are power grids going? And I think what we've come to the conclusion at the broad level is that China is driving the energy transition. China is adopting huge, huge amounts of wind and solar, but also building a little more hydro and more nuclear. So they are, in fact, so they're driving that. Everybody's scrambling to keep up. So now you see even the Americans are adopting a lot of wind and solar into their power grid. And it seems like every year we underestimate the amount of renewables that are adopted because they're clean and cheap. And if I was an investor sitting here looking at an asset that would have to run for at least 20 years to get my money back, maybe 30 years, and now every year it looks more and more like it could be a stranded asset. You know, it's one thing if you're a cutter and you're the low cost producer in the global market. It's another thing if you're the high cost, like the Russians are. But if you're in the middle, like Canada is, along with the US, you're sitting there going, well, am I going to be a stranded asset? You know, and so I can see where those projects, like the ones on the West Coast of Canada, are caught in that indecision, in that uncertainty. Those are often the ones that, you know, that get delayed and are tough for to find FIDs on. And I can't help but think the more, you know, work we do on this at Energy Media, that it is going to be an electric world. And it'll be here a lot quicker than we thought. And that is just not best environment in which to build more LNG plants.
Yeah, and we've come to the same conclusion. You know, those plants that are under construction in BC right now probably have a pretty good decade of profits ahead of them. They've got contracts that are guaranteed. You know, after that, as you say, people just every year underestimate the pace and scale of renewable build out worldwide. And now we've got battery grid storage at costs that are approaching, you know, parity with anything you could have from any other energy source. And some of these batteries are just going to be massive. You know, we're seeing gigawatt scale utility storage out there right now. And then the other thing people tend to forget is that it's not just about the generation. It's actually about the transmission. You know, you're going to see more grid interties for load balancing being built across North America, where you can send power around fairly quickly. It's going to be run by AI. It's going to be digitized a whole lot better. It's going to be a very, very kind of thoughtful system of kind of energy transfers. So that's going to happen. And then the other one that people tend to forget is, you know, we are going to have distributed energy resources in a big way in North America over the next decade. You know, your car is going to have vehicle to grid capability. You know, you'll be able to load balance and make a bit of money, you know, depending on when you've charged it. You know, your house may have rooftop solar, your community kind of may have community batteries, which protects you from wildfire and other, you know, emergencies that may happen to your community. So there's a whole different way of thinking about energy that's coming along. And I think, you know, BC, Canada, North America, we're not the only ones doing that. China's already there, as you say. You know, they have now built brand new coal-fired power plants that haven't turned on. And the reason for that is because the renewable energy beside them is so much cheaper. You know, we're seeing renewable energy being produced, you know, down at the 2 cents a kilowatt hour. You just cannot beat that anywhere else, especially if you can store it. So, you know, it really is a question for governments around, you know, how much financial incentives do they put forward to some of these projects that are still in the design stage or still in the project approval stage. So
we're going to get to the issue of households in a minute, I promise, listeners. But I don't want to abandon this question of where we're going globally and in a more general sense, because if we're electrifying at this pace, I'm concerned that Canada, the Canadian energy conversation, is way too overloaded with discussions about the energy of the 20th century, the oil production, the gas production, the LNG production. Meanwhile, we spend very little time having a conversation about the energy of the 21st century, which is primarily going to be electricity generated by some sort of, you know, renewables, whether it's mostly wind and solar, but then some hydro, then some nuclear, then some geothermal, all of that sort of. We spend very little time talking about that. And we underestimate the risks from the transition. We underappreciate the opportunities that are presented to us because we're not having the fulsome conversation that we should have. And here I am doing yet another podcast on LNG when there are so many other things. Like this morning, I interviewed John O'Donnell, the CEO of Rondo Energy, who's they built a heat battery that will work with wind and solar to decarbonize industrial processes. And it's basically built around 200-year-old brick technology that the steelmakers in Britain have used for like literally 200 years. And we should be talking about those sorts of innovations, not about whether or not rehashing this old question about whether LNG should be built or shouldn't be built. If I had my way, I'd stop at phase one of LNG Canada, and we'd get on with the hard work of building what needs to be done over the next 30 years, the infrastructure and all of everything that comes with it. So that's my little rant, Mark. It bothers me that we're yet having another conversation, but here we are.
No argument here. I think our general consensus and our advice to government is these projects need to stand on their own two merits. Like, they need to be able to self-finance. They need to be able to kind of get through and navigate regulatory processes. They need to operate, you know, without any more level of subsidies or incentives than any other sector or industry would get. And then, you know, ultimately, end of the day, they need to show their math that their product is going to be a global climate solution. So I think that's kind of where we are coming from on our work.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And you guys, we should acknowledge that Clean Energy Canada does a fine job and all of that. I know, read many of the studies that your organization puts out, and it's very credible work. Well, let's finally get to the households. I've been promising listeners that we would talk about this. What does your report say about the impact, potential impact of LNG build-out on households in British Columbia? And I'm particularly interested because, as the comic strip used to say, I is one.
I is one. Yeah, well, we're all ratepayers in one way or shape or form, whether you're on gas or whether you're on electricity. So we don't have any hard numbers or any modeling around what would happen to utility electricity rates, you know. But again, anybody that studies the markets would realize that if you have a whole bunch of large off-takers that are using up BC's electricity, we have to import, you know, what we import costs what more than we produce here. That delta is going to be picked up by the ratepayer, which is you and I, or the taxpayer, which is also you and I. So it's really hard to say what exactly would happen. We just do know that buying on the spot market is expensive right now. And yes, you know, hydro can buy power when it's very cheap or when the rates are actually negative, which is great. But when you guarantee 24/7 load to industrial proponents, you know, LNG and others, you know, you have to meet those loads. So you have to buy the electricity when it's needed or generate it here when it's needed. The other thing, too, that I think most people have not yet thought of, and I don't think governments have got their head around it yet either, is the phenomenon that's happening in the U.S. in those jurisdictions that are, you know, producing natural gas, you know, or exporting it. And they're finding that the utility gas bills, you know, have gone up almost 30% in some areas. And that's, again, it's a scarcity question, right? You know, we will have a new way to move gas out of BC, you know, rather than use it domestically or through the Henry Hub. And that's going to put upward pressure on utility gas rates. And again, that may or may not happen in BC because we have such a large reserve, but it's just something to be aware of and something to pay attention to.
I have made the argument in the past that the least risk, but still that provides a reasonable return for the producers, is to backfill the American LNG expansion. You know, to ship more down south of the border as their LNG output increases. They, of course, are put a strain on their domestic producers, and these prices go up. So backfill by exporting more, producing more in Canada, sending more of it south of the border, assuming, of course, that we have the pipeline capacity to do that, as opposed to spending tens of billions of dollars building out the LNG on the West Coast and then risking stranded assets. Yeah. And I know, you know, the argument will be from some that the LNG, if we build out LNG and it turned into stranded assets, well, that's the investor's problem. Oh, no, it's not. Because one of the things the oil and gas industry has done throughout its history in North America is walk away from uneconomic assets. It is not required under any regulatory regime in North America. And boy, Alberta is the biggest example of that. It is not required to provide security or funding at the beginning against cleanup down the road. So it's not inconceivable. You could imagine a worst case scenario where LNG Canada goes bust sometime in the 2030s and just walks away from their plant. Well, who has to clean that up? It's taxpayers that have to clean that up. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's government's job to make sure that these facilities are properly bonded. So, you know, end of life is addressed and taken care of. We're seeing more of that in the oil and gas sector, particularly for the upstream assets, you know, where they have to have kind of end of life plans. We're seeing it in mining a bit more now, where you're actually looking for sureties and bonding. So I would expect that we would see in the future the same happen with gas plants. And in terms of kind of exporting gas to the U.S., 25% of BC's gas already goes into the U.S. market. And, you know, as you say, most of that will probably end up in LNG at some point. So, you know, to say that BC is not kind of helping our friends and, you know, helping out with LNG and natural gas exports, we already are and have been for many years now.
I want to make one final point before we go. And that is, I remember about 5 years ago, Bruce Ralston, who was the energy minister at the time, he was you know, taking actions to break contracts with independent power producers. And he said, look, as things grow, we know we're going to have electrification down the road. We'll buy cheap California solar. And getting back to this, my conversation this morning with John from Rondo Energy, the Californians understand as well as anybody the costs of curtailing solar and how cheap solar is there. And there are so many companies mobilizing to take advantage of that resource. Why wouldn't they? I mean, it's either a marginal cost of zero or it's less than zero. You know, it's a negative price, which would be is perfect if you're the buyer. Somebody's paying you to take their electricity. And why wouldn't you be making hydrogen or putting in a Rondo battery and storing that energy longer duration than you can with a battery? That kind of stuff. And the idea that BC can rely on this long-term supply of cheap solar from the U.S., from California, because it's going to be available that long, I think is a pipe dream.
Yeah,
I don't think that's going to be the case at all.
No, I think you're going to watch that duck curve basically get subsumed by industry. We'll turn it into hydrogen or kinetic or battery storage or some sort of way of kind of capturing it. The other thing, too, is the Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S. Under the production tax credits created this really interesting incentive is that if you're not generating, you're not getting your production tax credit. So, you know, there is now a very big incentive for the market in the U.S. to be able to figure out kind of, you know, how to monetize, you know, that part of the day where overproduction occurs. And, you know, so meanwhile, you know, BC will take what it can and preserve our reservoirs. But I agree with you. I think the solar overproduction is a very short-term market fluctuation.
And we should also point out that the IRA is already responsible for over $100 billion worth of investment in new manufacturing facilities. And what do manufacturing facilities use as energy? Electricity. So as the Americans build out their clean energy technology manufacturing, whether that's wind and solar, solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, electric vehicles, heat pumps, whatever it is, they're all going to require more and more power. That's a given. And I would suggest that Canada, if it's thinking of importing power from the U.S., maybe would take that out of their plan. There's too much. The situation in the U.S. is too fluid,
yep,
too uncertain to depend on. We need to stick to our knitting back at home and do the hard work here of re-engineering our electricity systems to meet the future rather than relying on somebody else to bail us out.
Yeah, absolutely. And people tend to forget in the U.S. too, is there, you know, enhanced oil recovery has a very finite lifespan ahead of it, another decade, decade and a half at best. Natural gas resources and all of their fracking operations, you know, their return on investment there kind of starting to decline now as those fields start to get tapped out. So, I mean, the U.S. is doing the right thing by electrification, and they're doing the right thing by figuring out how do they keep the power all for themselves. So I agree with you on that. And I think Canada and Canadian provinces need to look carefully around south of the border and figure out, like, what is our larger energy strategy and energy plan look like?
Oh, goodness, you brought up the topic of energy planning. The bugaboo of policy wonks across Canada. How did we get to 2024 and not have an energy plan, an energy strategy? We have lots of provinces that don't even have an energy strategy, which to say is that Canada needs to hitch up its pants and get to it, because we have lagged too long in this. But we could go on all day about this. Mark, thank you very much. Really appreciate your insights.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.